Chris Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA1977 on Twitter.
Nimmers Netter, just talking to teachers.
Okay, hello everybody and welcome to this episode of Nailers Natter. And this week our guest is Andrew Cowley, and the book we are talking about is The Wellbeing Curriculum, Embedding Children's Wellbeing in Primary Schools. So welcome, Andrew.
Hi there, Phil. Good to see you.
For doing this. Yes, likewise. And we can see each other, listener. We can see each other down the barrel of our wonderful Zencaster. So Andrew's looking fresh and relaxed this morning. Me, not so much. So apologies, listeners, for my voice, which is the result of the half-term cold. You feel compelled to say it's not COVID. I have done the tests, but even so, you know, I have got a little bit of a sore throat. But we're going to battle on regardless. And also, as well as Andrew joining us, we have a previous guest and regular contributor to the podcast, Lisa Fathers. So welcome, Lisa.
Morning. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Lisa.
And we can't see Lisa down the barrel of Zencaster, as you know, she's just a fitness machine. So she's literally stepped out of a spinning class to come straight into this, listeners. So we're very lucky that you're there. So thank you, Lisa, for being there.
No problems. Just to give that a bit of context, it was a Halloween spin class as well. So I don't think anyone would recognize me anyway.
Well, don't worry, we're not releasing any videos. So it's all good. It's all good. Okay, so let's get into the book. So like I said, the book is Wellbeing Curriculum, Embedding Children's Wellbeing in Primary Schools, and it's a Bloomsbury production. So we're going to start off with a quote from the introduction, Andrew, if we can. So the more we are concerned for the wellbeing of others, the closer we feel to each other. And that's from the Dalai Lama. So first of all, Andrew, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Phil. It's a lovely sunny morning on our record. I've been avoiding the showers we've had so far today, and I'm feeling relaxed and very casual today.
Excellent. Okay, so we're going to get straight into the book. How does the wellbeing curriculum build on 2019's excellent The Wellbeing Toolkit?
Well, thank you, Phil. Thank you for that recommendation. Well, Wellbeing Toolkit was written principally because I was looking to address issues of retention and recruitment in education, and thinking about what well-being actually looked like for our staff, so including our teaching assistants as well as our teachers and our senior leaders. And what I wanted to do was try and dismiss a few myths about well-being. And the principal myth is that you can address that with a few cakes on the staff room table and a bit of mindfulness and meditation. But well-being looks very different for everyone. Because we're individuals, we're people, we all have our own sensibilities and sensitivities. So well-being isn't unique to everyone. The way this is built on it, it's designed in part as a companion piece, but it can sit on its own. But they do tie together because I've always been very values-led as a school leader. And values are incredibly important. We can't dictate values to everyone, but I do have my own, which I do stick to, and I do you bring across in the book, and I repeat in both books exactly the same principles, such as celebration and trust and respect, and bring those together because I believe in a wider context of what well-being is for children. We need to look bigger than that, think about character education, and also think about how that contributes to children being good citizens in the future. So ultimately, well-being is not just something to keep us well in what we're doing. Well-being is a life skill, and that's what I've tried to bring across in my writing.
Definitely. And before we bring Lisa in on the next question, in terms of the introduction, Andrew, you've kind of helped the reader go through and suggest some ways that potentially the reader can use this book. It's very much a living book, isn't it? It's not something that you're just going to read through once and then kind of leave on the shelf. It's something you're going to return back to and hopefully use in your day-to-day practice. So is there a suggested way for the listener to use your book?
Yes, indeed. There's, everyone's more than welcome to dip into individual chapters, for example. So there's a chapter principally about bullying. There's one on cyberbullying, there's one on e-safety. But the way I'd envisage it being used, it's almost on a three-part model. And this went back to actually my early days in teaching as to how I believed children should approach curriculum, schools should approach curriculum, which is very much on a spiral model, so coming back and revisiting different aspects of curriculum again. But I've broken the book up into three parts. So you've got looking after themselves, so self-awareness and mental health is the very first chapter of the actual contents of the book. Then that will build on to looking after others. So once you know looking after yourself, how to look after others, which includes chapters on bullying, aspects of kindness, cyberbullying, e-safety, and trust come into that as well. And then the final section is putting those wellbeing values into action. So going back to the values that I mentioned before. So I've got chapters on developing children as young leaders. I've got one on diversity and equality, which addresses the whole range of diversity within that. And a final chapter of putting your values into action, how to live your values as a young person and how the school might help to embed and embody those values in the work that the school is doing in terms of its school culture.
Excellent. So in terms of the structure of the book, we've just been through how you can potentially use that and the three different sections in there. And each chapter's also got a helpful summary at the end, and you kind of pull it all together and talk about what a school that does those particular things might look like. So Lisa's probably going to follow up on this question, but I'll start with the first chapter. So what does a school that prioritises wellbeing and character education look like?
Right. If you're doing it well, empathy and honesty are very prominent in what the school are going to offer. And they're not things you can simply teach in one lesson. It's got to be there within the spirit of the whole school, and actually it goes beyond lessons. It's got to cover things like playtimes and lunchtimes, assemblies, the way children deal with each other in the corridor, the way they speak to adults, the way the adults speak back to them. That enables character to actually be shown, because character is one of those things, again, like happiness lessons. How can you teach those? And you can certainly cover it in a lesson, but how do you teach it? How do you actually live it? Things like character actually only come about with how children and adults conduct themselves around the rest of the school. And I don't want to mention the O word, but when schools are inspected, it is something that inspectors do look for. They look at the way children are around the rest of the school and make judgments based upon that, because that is a reflection of how the whole ethos and culture of the school is actually being embedded in what the children do.
Lisa, do you want to come in on that?
Yeah, great. Thank you. So really interesting. And it's definitely on my Christmas list, this book. So I'm looking forward to reading it. Although I have read excerpts of it because you helpfully shared that on social media. So it was brilliant to gain a little bit of an insight into it. I guess my questions are, linked to what you said so far, and you said, it's in the spirit of the school. How does that translate, do you think, for a multi-academy trust where you obviously want to try and have the right culture of well-being at the heart of everything across your mat, but equally, each school has its own distinct character and ethos as well, and you want to preserve that?
That's an interesting question. So obviously, mats in recent years have been on the agenda and are now the business model that many teachers work in. And school character, individual school character is vitally important. I've only worked in individual schools, I've not worked in a mat. So I've contributed a lot in what I've done as a senior leader and as a developing teacher to creating that culture in a school. Principles and values, I'll come back to that. They're probably crucial to building that further. And that's got to be driven from the top. And I think if the leadership of the MAP, whether it's coming from the CEO, whether it's coming from the executive heads, the heads of school, they need to be singing from the same hymn sheet, as it were, thinking about things like behaviour policy, for example, which some schools call a well-being policy.
Yeah.
It's an interesting aside. Being absolutely consistent within that, knowing exactly what the rules and expectations of behaviour and relating to work are, they need to be consistent between the schools.
Sorry, guys, the kids have just walked in.
Theoretically, you've got a business model that can be teachers can bounce from one school to the other as part of the professional development, and that makes it much easier for them as well. And of course, it could also happen with the children. If you're a multi-academy trust, you've got primaries and secondaries, and if children are moving within that trust as they go on to secondary, that's embedding those values in the same way is an important step, I think.
That's great, Andrew. Thank you. And just following on from that, we keep hearing the rhetoric around post-COVID, but actually those of us that are in schools regularly know that we're still in the midst of it, really. Yeah. So how do you think your book could be used as a tool to support recovery? I guess it's probably easier to say post-lockdown than post-COVID.
Post-lockdown. Yeah, that's interesting. When I started writing, certainly was planning it and writing my submission, we didn't know that we were getting a pandemic, and then we were there. And as I was starting to write, we were thinking about going through what lockdown was. I've stuck to the principles I was going to use through anyway, but it's made me realise. I think a lot of people who've read the book so far have realised that yes, we do have an increased emphasis on mental health issues with children. And I know there's been some discussion which is trying to deny that there is a mental health crisis, but that's not what I'm hearing. Teachers I've spoken to, formally and informally, have said, yeah, children are coming back and their anxieties are increased. Some first time around in 2020, what we're finding was that even though the children had that wonderfully hot weather and they're able to go outside, they were missing their friends. And this is a point where people were really scared of COVID. You know, thinking if you went more than 2 metres close to somebody, you'd catch it. So children were really definitely missing their friends, and that was an extended time that they were away. But also there was that definite missing of their teachers, which not all children, when children get to about 10 or 11, they wouldn't dare admit that. But there was definitely that feeling that they were missing the consistency with their teachers. And then we come to January 2021 when we had lockdown three. That was different in that still full lockdown, but also this time there was the requirement that children had to be available for online teaching. And that created a completely different barrier. They're still there doing their learning, but they're online, and it went against a lot of the things we said about spending too much time online. And chatting with children, parents of children who were in year six particularly, what those parents would often find is not only was it difficult to get children online because they weren't the devices, but if they were online, they'd have the tab of Google Classroom, would there be another tab of Minecraft or another tab of some other game or chat room that they were in, and were they spending all their time upon that? So I think that's one of the areas of relevance where that comes in terms of post-pandemic, post-lockdown recovery, because that's changed what children have gone through.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's great. I guess the other thing that I think is quite interesting, when I read the excerpts of your book and listened to what you say, I think what you say really reflects the Well Schools movement. So I have got a number of hats that I wear on a daily basis, and I'm chair of the National Well Schools Board. And the whole ethos behind Well Schools and the movement of Well Schools is that schools will put well-being at the heart of everything, which I think is what you're saying, really, that actually it's just at the centre of the school, and it underpins absolutely everything and every decision that's made.
Yeah, if it's underpinning and it's not there as a, if it's there as a tick box or as a token, yeah, then it's pointless. Don't do it.
Absolutely.
It's got to be there. It's got to be there for, it's in everything. It's in every moment of the school day. It doesn't mean every lesson's about well-being, but the way lessons are conducted, the way children interact, the way children are supported, the way staff are supported, it's, the whole ethos is about living well, being well.
That's great. So, Andrew, in terms of, you know, sometimes we see, don't we, on social media platforms that there are some people that believe that those schools that prioritise well-being are doing so at the expense of high expectations, routines, systems, you know, knowledge-rich curriculums. What would you say to those people in terms of demonstrating that actually you can do both?
Yeah. Well, first thing to realise is that social media isn't real life, and loud voices on Twitter don't mean that everyone thinks that. But if I was to not talk about what people on social media think, I'd actually say that I think the two do go together. My experience on that is based on, again, my real life experience. While I was in primary school, I taught very often year six children, and which is just interesting. Chatterfield, as a science teacher, we had a link with a local secondary school, and involved in some work where we went there and they came to us. We had a lesson on gravity, and we were dropping boiled eggs from different kinds of balloons and parachutes and seeing what we could save. And that lesson went on the entire afternoon, and the children were very, very much engaged. And I remember the teacher saying to me, what happens to these kids when they get to year seven? I said, this class is absolutely perfectly engaged, every single one of them, whatever their need, whatever their background, they're all engaged in it, they're chatting, all the talks about science. But they get to year seven, and they either don't engage or they misbehave. What happens? And I couldn't answer that question at the time. But I think over time I sort of realised that where there's inconsistencies, I think perhaps between different primary schools and different expectations, children, when they mix in, yeah, typical secondary school in part of London where I work, might have taken children from anywhere up to between 30 and 40 primary schools, 30, 40 different sets of backgrounds and expectations that are there. I always included well-being character within my teaching, even though I might not have been aware of it. It's reflection over time has made me realise I was doing that. But if those expectations aren't there everywhere else, that, I think, could be the crucial thing. And if you've got your expectation is just work, do as well as you can, because that's how schools are judged, are you providing the rest of the background? Because ultimately, as our children grow, they're not examination machines. And if it's great if they can pass exams, but they don't know how to deal with somebody I meet in public, they don't know how to look after somebody in distress on the internet, then those are skills, life skills that we're missing. And the two need to go together. We've got high expectations. High expectations are not just in work, but high expectations go with what children are like as well. My experience has always been the children who have got those expectations about looking after each other and looking after themselves, they're the ones that do best academically as well as pastorally. We've got to have a curriculum that sits, pastoral curriculum that sits alongside and astride our academic curriculum.
Definitely.
Thanks,
great
Andrew.
Questions, Lisa. So we're definitely going to come back to you with a few more follow-up questions on the next few. But we dip back into the book, and there's been a lot of discussion around this kind of thing this week. You mentioned on social media. I don't want to get into that. However, the question is, how can the listener promote a culture of good manners and social skills?
That, I really think, is going to come down to modelling and the values that you share with everyone else. I had my book launch this week, and I was asked by my colleague Kelly, who wrote the foreword for the book, for some story from my youth. And I found a blog that I'd written for Women Ed a few years ago. We were asked to share our sheroes, and I told a tale about my grandmother, who passed away over 30 years ago now. But I was her eldest grandchild, and after my grandfather died, when I was just before I was two, so she spent a lot of time helping look after me. I think having me around was a nice way of filling the gap from my grandpa passing away. As the eldest grandchild, she'd often take me out, and she liked to take me to the Botanic Gardens Cafe in Southport, which might be familiar to some people. My favourite drink when I was about 4 years of age was a milkshake. And my grandmother wanted me to be independent. So she sent me with the money. I think it was might even been pre-decimal at that time, to go and order my milkshake. As I ordered that, when it came over, it wasn't the normal one that came. It was in a sundae glass. It had all fruit in it, cream, and it was extra special. And my grandmother said, "Well, that's what we ordered." And they said, "The first to know you, your grandson's so well mannered. We'd like to reward you with this." And I think that's a story I often tell in assembly, because that was a model that my grandmother had set. So if we have models equally set in schools, expectations like that, it's not for reward, but they're just an expectation of what good conduct and good behaviour is. If we model those good manners and recognise those manners, it only takes a thank you. Only takes a nod of recognition. Sometimes you might give a reward in school for it in some way. But building it's all in the culture and the manners and the expectation that you have that will help embed that.
It's such a good story. I'm just thinking I've done quite a lot with my own kids, trying to make them more resilient. Not because I'm lazy, but quite often because I'm, half-term single parenting with a dog from grandma. So it's quite hard to go into a shop. So by a kind of fluke, they've had to become extremely well-mannered. But they've not been well-mannered enough to get a free milkshake, Andrew, yet. So they do need work on that.
It's going back in the old days.
They do need work. But in terms of what you're saying there about manners and social skills, and Lisa might want to follow up on this, in terms of our trust and the kind of values there, so ambition, respect, resilience, we talk about respect quite a lot. And one thing that we've done practically is our school, most of our students walk to school, or they get the bikes to school. They don't tend to be busting. They live in the area. So they walk to school in the morning. And something that we quite big on is, as everybody else probably is, high-vis jackets, and we walk down the main road as far as the corner where the pub is, where the students come in. And we've really worked hard on saying good morning to everybody. And it was a slow start, let me tell you, Andrew. You know, we were saying good morning, and they were looking at us like, what? You know, good morning, morning. And slowly, over the space of time, you know, the last couple of years or so, we're now getting more good mornings. And actually, students are now greeting us with a good morning before we've got a chance to say anything to them. And the same thing on the way out, you know, enjoy your weekend, sir. You know, have a good evening, that sort of thing. So it's massive, and it just really starts to feed that culture, doesn't it, in terms of good manners and social skills.
It's only seems a little thing, but I think it's just massively important. And I'd echo that again from, you know, when I was at school and I did gate duty, every morning it'd be good morning to everyone, even if they were a bit grumpy, because it's that instant contact. And also, you can notice things, because sometimes children do come in a bit grumpy and a bit upset. I give you a point where you can say, "Oh, do you have a quick word? Find out anything." And sort of safeguarding wise, that's really important. But also, that greeting with parents. Obviously, you don't get that in secondary or primary, so you very much do. And again, that point of contact, it's really crucial with parents, because it's very easy for parents to feel sort of disengaged with the school. But if you're always there and they know you're a point of contact, then that actually makes it easier. If you've got an issue, they've already got a positive relationship to build that issue from. if there's no relationship there and you've got a negative interaction you need to have with them, it always becomes more challenging. So, so we do need to think about our parents and the well-being, our well-being triangulation as well.
Definitely.
Thanks, Andrew. And I think that's a really good example, Phil, of how you role model those interactions and dialogue between teachers and students, because not all children will get those role models. And I think that if you think about the context of mobile phones and the interactions that are on the increase with technology, actually those fundamentals of talking to each other and being polite and opportunities to converse are almost reducing, aren't they? I think the other thing that you talked about, Phil, without realizing it, was the importance of exercise. So if we think about the fundamentals of well-being being sleep, diet and exercise, you know, not only are you encouraging the dialogue, but you're encouraging the children to walk to school, which is obviously setting them up for a great day because they're beginning the day with moving. Mm-hmm. You both talked about resilience a lot, and in your book you make reference to that. How far do you think sport plays a part in building resilience, Andrew, in terms of PE and the curriculum? You know, often we see it being squeezed, but as you know, I'm a big advocate for making sure that it's...
Yeah, it's a great shame when I see it squeezed, because when I first started teaching, reception classes would have a PE session each day. Well, it was a great period of time, because most of the PE lessons actually spent getting changed, but they'd have it each day. But as SATs came in, there's more pressure. PE was often the one that was squeezed. And I think that was a great shame that was going. And there is an expectation children have got 2 hours of physical exercise in schools. I think it's incredibly important that's kept in place. And I've always been a great admirer of the Youth Sports Trust, Lisa, as I know you are as well. I was involved in their TOPS training scheme a number of years ago.
Yeah, I think showing your age a bit there, Andrew, that was a long time ago.
I was actually a trainer on that.
Oh, brilliant.
And I went and did the training. And I'll tell you how long ago it was, because that was the day that Tony Blair became Prime Minister.
Wow.
That's the day I had my training.
Wow.
But that was all about, because PE was the first subject I led in school, very... very stereotypical to give it to the only man on the staff, PE. But I was very aware of equality of opportunity, so allowing gender opportunity, disability opportunity came through that as well. But sport's also important, not just in the competitive side, because life is competitive, so children do need to have, if they can, the opportunity to represent the school. But also in terms of giving those chances to those children who aren't going to be the natural athletes, who aren't going to go on to play for a team in their own time, but actually create a notion of being physically active. They might not go and play football or cricket or tennis, but they might enjoy a run. They might enjoy the fresh air and going out and walking on a regular basis. They might engage themselves in some other activity. Lots of schools, including the school I was most recently at, get involved in things like boxing, not for the aggressive side, but because of the physicality and the control side. I think it's a side of sport we often forget. So certainly sport, physicality has an important role within well-being. Not just for keeping fit, but also in terms of character development.
That's brilliant. Thanks, Andrew.
Okay, so linking into exercise, we're going to talk a little bit about diet, and you talk about the importance of healthy eating. So do parents need support in preparing healthier lunches? And I guess, with everything in the news at the moment around universal credit, squeeze, etc., is that more of a challenge in disadvantaged communities?
I think that definitely can be. And again, in the schools I've worked in, we've always had a large number of disadvantaged children. And one thing that the families have found a challenge is managing budgets with food. And very often you'd see, if they came with packed lunches, it'd often be a pre-packed and pre-prepared things. winders, pepperamis, etc., which are actually more expensive than fresh ingredients. But the issue there is not only one of helping manage budgets, but also of awareness of the kinds of things that children can be having for their lunches. And one thing I've advocated there, and my friend Kelly, who wrote the foreword, did in her school, was have parent workshops where they can just actually discuss things like this. One of the I never got around to it, but always really wanted to, was actually having parent workshops involving some food prep, and actually to talk through things like budget and nutrition, and how easy it is to press some carrot sticks, for example, and different things can go with the carrot sticks, without being a patronising way. But I think it's that kind of approach is quite important to do. One challenge I actually gave the children, which actually outlined in one of the assemblies in the book, I actually did this for real life. We talked about the UN sustainability goals. And one of those actually focuses on the fact that so many children and families in the world have got to live on less than a pound a day for their food budget. So what I did, I called up a few volunteers from the school, there was eight of them, there's two from each year group. And the challenge I gave them was to see if they could plan a meal. I actually sent them to supermarket websites for equivalent of a pound each per member of the house. And they came back the next week with that. Some of the print had got things straight off the websites of the supermarkets, but two of them had actually not only done that, they'd actually gone out and bought the ingredients and cooked it and came back with photographs to actually show what that was. And there was one child had they'd done a pasta dish with vegetable sauce, and I think it amounted to 75 pence per member of the family, which is an absolute stunning example of how you can actually do that. So the parents spent the time with them, had them prepare, but also they showed their independence. Lessons like that, I think, are really quite important to do, but in a way that's not patronising to parents or threatening to parents. So I don't really want to be dictated to by school, but certainly having going back to that modelling, I think that's quite important.
Naylor's Natter, just talking to teachers.
Thanks, Andrew. That's I really like that example, and I think, you know, that parents, you know, they do want to learn from school, but equally we have to understand, don't we, that for a lot of parents, their memories of school, you know, aren't always really positive. So engaging with parents in different ways is really important, and where we engage with parents as well, because
that's right. I'd echo that. Many parents had negative experiences, had exclusion from secondary schools, and lack of trust that was there with schools, and you very very often the response of typical school, typical teacher, thinking of sort of authority figures and not as support and almost like social supporting figures was not always there, but I believe that's changed. Changed in schools, good cultures.
Yeah, and of course the challenge in some schools is that parents are over engaging and you know always in touch with schools. So it's a fine balance, isn't it, for leaders and teachers to manage. Can I just come in and talk to you a little bit about staff wellbeing, which obviously is also at the heart of your work, and you know, you've talked about, you know, wellbeing for staff being bespoke and the fact that it's not the same for everybody. Mm. And I completely agree with all that. One of the things that has really struck me in the last couple of years as a woman that reaches a certain age of mid 40s is the lack of support and knowledge around perimenopause. And obviously was sitting here talking in the same week that there's been a parliamentary menopause bill this week to try and get hormone replacement therapy, you know, to be supplied for women in the same way that contraception is. and which obviously I'm all for, because I find it bizarre that in this day and age, you know, women are so undervalued that only women that can afford prescriptions can have the right support for hormone replacement therapy. Mm-hmm. I just wondered what your thoughts were, Andrew, around, you know, the place for menopause awareness in schools. When you think about the majority of the teaching workforce being female, we're kind of in the right arena to think about it, aren't we?
We are indeed, yeah. I think in all the time I've been teaching, I never saw anything about menopause awareness from local authorities. No, it didn't come up at all yet. Half the population of the world is going to experience that at some point in time. And as you say correctly, at least in the vast majority of the teaching profession is female, and that's an experience they're going to have. There needs to be an awareness. There needs to be knowledge of how to support staff. There needs to be knowledge of things to look out for, because again, it's something I think the press and the media in the last few years have actually made talking about the menopause easier. But yeah, there's many people that don't like talking about personal things and would hide that away. And you might be a change in the persona that somebody gives across because they are finding their personal health has been affected. One thing I talk about in the first book is knowing your staff. When I talk about knowing your staff, it's not just a conversation knowing where they went on holiday or the names of their kids, that's important, but really knowing them is knowing what's going on in their lives. So a different culture where there is space to support and talk with each other about what's going on in your life and not being judgmental, not dismissing somebody because they can't do something because of their health issue or a mental health issue or something that's going on at home. And that is exactly where the whole agenda of discussing menopause in school actually fits in effectively. And I'm so glad that has come up. And I do hope that's going to get greater attention.
Thanks, Andrew. That's great.
Okay, thank you, Lisa. So something that I'm particularly interested in terms of the day job and something that Lisa's massively involved in as well. In fact, the teaching school have run quite a few courses around, you know, the updates to keeping children safe in education and particularly around sort of sexual harassment, which is in some way linked to online safety. So with that update around schools' responsibility for people's online safety, what do you think about schools that have introduced mobile phone bans, for example, and, you know, how should we educate pupils on the use of devices?
Yeah, I think a blanket ban, I know schools have done it, and obviously the more vocal schools have done that. The point to bear in mind there, children being children, tell them not to do something, they'll do it. So banning something doesn't always work because there are always going to be children who find ways of bringing a phone into school. We need to come back and think about the other side, not the danger side of it, but the safe way of using a phone. Some primary secondary schools allow phones in school and allow it as part of their learning. Others won't because they know that there'll be things that go on that shouldn't be happening, social media communication, that kind of thing. I think the onus here is on primary schools and having a discussion in primary schools with children about the use of phones, because what I found is increasingly younger children have got access to smartphones and sometimes their own smartphone. And there's something I refer to as device envy comes in. It goes back to remember our youth and who had the particular trendy trainer, so trainer envy, or who had which brand of sportswear, that became a form of envy. But now that envy comes into devices. It's great knowing the name of the device, but what we need to teach is not what the trendy device is. We need to teach what the device is for and what the device can do and how it can be useful for us, but how also to keep ourselves safe. So not so much in terms of teaching danger here, it's bad man here, people do things like this and that and the other, and they can track your details, but teaching about how to keep ourselves safe online, how to recognise a sign that might be a concern, how to recognise behaviour that might be a concern, and how to respond to that, who to tell, not to keep it secret. And the secret side, that would really just tie in with keeping children safe, because we don't keep secrets. That's one of the key things of safeguarding, whatever aspect it's always been about. So primaries need to take the grasp the nettle on the phones. Certainly have rules about phones. Primary schools, what experience I've had, only children 6 and 5 had them. What would happen, they'd be collected in by the teacher at the beginning of the day, put in an envelope with a name on, and there'd be blocks go out of the office for safekeeping, and that'd be collected at the end of the day or given out as a children go. So they weren't using the phone on the playground, they weren't taking pictures, which again, is temptations that children often have. So get that education in early, get that safety in early, get that culture of safety in early, I think is the thing. But if you go for a blanket ban, I think that's the likelihood is that they'll find ways around it.
Andrew, yeah. I just on, listening sorry, to you then, thinking about what you were saying, and my son is in year 4 and he has 100% got device envy. I can't believe how things have changed in the last few years. So my daughter wanted a phone and we refused to get her one until she was going into year 7. And now my son's in year 4 and he's literally the only one in his friendship group that doesn't have a phone.
Yeah.
And it's just so bizarre. And, you know, they've all got TikTok.
There is that,
and they've
that
got
peer
access.
Pressure as well.
Yeah.
Well, I often find children come to say, oh, I'm getting the iPhone 9 next year. I'm getting the iPhone X. Oh, my uncle's getting an upgrade and I'm getting his old phone. Well, why do you need that? Is one question I might ask.
Absolutely. It's really
does come in. It's peer pressure, but it's also family pressure as well. And families don't always know about safe access and what to do if there's a problem. And I think increasingly schools are dealing with issues that come about from misuse of phones. Every single year as a deputy head, I had to deal with something coming down to children using a phone and using it inappropriately. So it's an issue, but it's an issue to be addressed appropriately, keeping children safe, but also as part of their wider education.
Yeah, I quite agree.
Okay, thank you both. No, that's fine. So in terms of something else that's quite topical, so again, hopefully we're getting this podcast out on the same day that we record it. So the listener will know that today is the day that the clocks go. And obviously those with young children, Lisa, won't have felt the benefits of that.
Absolutely.
Some people got an extra hour in bed. But as obviously lighter mornings mean darker evenings. So I really like the chapter around keeping children safe. And one of the lines that I like there, Andrew, that you put is, how do we emphasise keeping children safe, not just avoiding danger?
I think it comes back to getting those habits right. You gave a great example there of going home. I mean, primary schools theoretically going home at 3:30, even in the middle of December, just before they break up. Yeah, at least they'll be going home in some daylight. But being safe, there's two sides to that. It's thinking about our own safety, be acting in a safe manner ourselves, but also possibly anticipating unsafe behaviours of others. If we go back to what is often seen as a bit of a slightly dry subject in school, which is road safety, for example, it's important that's taught, but it always seems to be taught in exactly the same way. And it becomes a bit too routine, and the danger of being routine is it isn't going to get adequate cover. So I always work with I've worked with JRSOs, for example, and they're usually children in year five. It's the Junior Road Safety Officers, people who aren't familiar with that acronym. And what we get to do with them is actually get them to think about the roads around the school. I mean, the schools I worked at, there's been a variety of them. The one I most recently left was on a side road, but basically it's one way in for traffic. So you had parents dropping off as well as children walking. And so part of our road safety work was how to cross that road safely, because you had cars parked as well as cars on the road. We didn't have a crossing patrol. So part of our work with the children is where to cross safely, where not to cross, with emphasis on being safe. But also not knowing how other cars might behave. We also covered some stuff on there about children using scooters. Many of them did start scooting to school. It was a local initiative. But we had them walking out of school on the scooter and not scooting down the drive. Again, keeping themselves safe so they didn't fall over, keeping themselves safe so they didn't bash into a parent or a buggy on the way out. So we emphasise being safe rather than emphasising being unsafe, because that encourages the safe practice. And if something unsafe did occur, then that can be particularly addressed. So fortunately, I never had an incident where a child was knocked over from my school the whole time I taught, but it does happen. But keep them safe first, I think, is always the emphasis.
Absolutely. Okay, so last one before, and Lisa might want to follow up on this one. So last one, Andrew, is going to be, in the week of the COP26 conference, how do we go about prioritising the environment? And obviously, that's hugely in the news at the moment.
It is huge, and it's something that children are concerned about. It was BBC Newsround did a survey in 2020, actually shortly before the first lockdown, indicating that some children are losing sleep over environmental issues. Most children interviewed for the survey indicated they're worried about climate change. One in five suggested they have bad dreams about it. We're very lucky, I think children are very lucky, they've got someone like Greta Thunberg who's raising concern about that. But also the way she's doing it, she's not gluing herself to a plane or to the pavement. She's using the power of her voice, and she's strong and she's strident, and that's an absolutely perfect way to model to our children that kind of action, by using their voices to do that. But if we're going to get children into good habits, actually a little bit of reverse psychology. I do talk in the book about giving children leadership opportunities. One of the most effective ones is actually give them a job of the environment monitor. Most schools will have a blue bin in the classroom. That should have your scraps of paper and your recyclables in it, and it shouldn't have other things. The most effective things I ever saw, and it was actually the job was actually given in one school to year two children, and they're often much more strident than year six, because they take the job terribly, terribly seriously. And I remember them collecting the bin from the staff room, and then going through the bin and knocking on the door and saying, right, this bit's got to go in the other bin. And they found things that teachers had put in that bin in the staff room that wasn't recyclable, and that that empowered the children a little bit, but also just showed showed staff who perhaps weren't aware of where things should go. So something like that's a very empowering thing to do.
I like that, Andrew. I've seen energy monitors used in some schools as well.
Yes, I have as well, who go around, they turn lights off in classrooms. If you're not in a school that's got one of those movement sensors, which turns the lights off, there's no movement in a room, it's always quite... it was slightly embarrassing in an exam, so obviously nobody's moving around. But that again, that's empowering. Shutting doors, thinking about drafts, habits they can bring into home as well. One of the most effective things that I did at my most recent one, I do mention that in the book, is that the local church always had a display of Christmas trees from local schools. Everyone had decorated their own. We decided that we would make a recycling point. So the children for a month before throughout the school had saved up plastic bottles, and we actually constructed those into a tree, which is very, very different from everything else that was there. And the look on the church warden's face is a bit of a picture. But we just said to them, we're making a point about environment and restructuring. That is why we designed our tree like that. And that was a potent symbol of children's thought that's about recycling.
Thanks. So just to follow up on that, I think it's also, isn't it, about staff's attitude to energy saving and that kind of strategic approach to saving energy, and reminding staff to turn laptops off and to turn lights off, but more than that, to think really carefully about travel, whether things need to be done where 10 people drive a significant distance using a significant amount of petrol and drive somewhere. But equally, we have to balance that off between people working individually, perhaps in their home offices with the heating on, when they could all be in one office with the heating on in one office. So I think it's about balancing, isn't it? The needs of an organization and the needs to collaborate and come together in person, but also, what that means in terms of the environment and the drain on it. But I think a lot of the things are to do with habits.
They are, yeah. And so what one person turning a radiator down by a degree might not in itself make a difference, but 10 people doing it makes 10 times difference. 100 people doing it makes 100 times difference. If you've got, I can remember a school of 230 children, 120 families, all those families do it, and their extended families
absolutely
do it, and all the teachers do it. That's a definite impact. Yeah.
And you come back to what you said before, Phil, about walking to school and cycling to school and, all those active travel initiatives are hugely beneficial as well. And, I think the environment links to the other conversation we had about diet, encouraging children and families and, staff in school to eat more vegetables, less meat. One school introduced something called meat-free Mondays, and these things are only little things, but they can have a massive impact, can't they?
Yeah, well, I think increasingly I've seen children embracing vegetarianism and veganism in school, partly through parents, and sometimes it's through faith as well. But my children definitely made decisions and about what they eat, and I've had children stand up and say why they made a decision to be vegetarian, and we've discussed what veganism is, and the very obvious questions children ask is do you just eat vegetables, and of course it's much more than that. But again, that gives opportunities for experimentation. If you've got something that should be in the primary curriculum as part of design technology, there should be food technology within that. And that's an ideal opportunity to introduce vegetarian and vegan concepts with the children, and even allow them to taste some things. There's an example I give in the book about a child that didn't like aubergines because they didn't like the colour of them, didn't like the color, they were purple, and we prepared some in class, and he actually ate one, and he said they were quite nice, and he was put off by the look of them.
I think you touched on something there really as well about, well, schools are those schools that are fully inclusive. And I think food and diet and trying different foods is a great way to explore other cultures, isn't it?
Oh, it is. Just before I moved to become a deputy, one thing I did at my previous school, we organised an international week because we were in a school that embraced a very large number of cultures, although the Nigerian, which were the population of about half the school. And we organised an evening where inviting children to bring in something from their own culture. And it involved the children from white UK backgrounds. So we had somebody brought in cream tea, somebody brought in finger sandwiches. But I remember the Nigerian families brought in all their different varieties of jollof rice, which I love jollof rice. And there was about 20 different ones, and I had to judge which was the best.
Oh, lovely. That must have been a hard job.
They were fantastic. They all had their different one. I never realised that there was that came down to very much personal choice in them. And that was an entertaining and informative evening for everyone. And I think that's it's a really simple thing for the school to just open up on a Thursday evening, week before half term. Nice way to end the half term, but to celebrate everyone. And the children came in their costumes, their own culture as well.
Oh, lovely.
Entertaining and informing, which could sum up the book, Andrew, couldn't it? It could sum up the podcast as well. So thank you so much for your time today. Just before we finish, could you just signpost listeners to a couple of things? So one, and most importantly, where they can get the book from. Can you also signpost to your social media feeds and to some of the launch events that you've done this week and whether they're recorded and whether people are able to access those kind of after the event?
So the Wellbeing Curriculum and the Wellbeing Toolkit are both available via Amazon. They're also on the Bloomsbury website. Occasionally, Bloomsbury do have a start of year discount, but they did with 30%, which has just expired, but I'll always alert people through social media to that. Social media, you can find me on Twitter at Andrew_Cowley23. I'm also on LinkedIn under my own name as well. At Healthy Toolkit was the group we set up on Twitter, which has got a blog attached to it, and the blog was the start of my writing journey. So there's about 80 blog posts on there, all bar two of which are written by me. So you can find some of my writing there, and I've done various other blogs for Education Support Partnership, BBC Teach, down the years. This week I did have an online launch event, which is on YouTube. Just search for Wellbeing Curriculum Launch, and you'll find that on there. There's myself, Kelly, Adrian Bethune, Therese Hoyle, Frederica Roberts, Nicola Owen, Maria O'Neill, and John McGee, who all spoke at my launch. And just as a little bonus at the end, my newborn granddaughter makes an appearance.
Fantastic. Right. Once again,
the R factor.
Yeah. So once again, the book is The Wellbeing Curriculum, Embedding Children's Wellbeing in Primary Schools. And as Andrew said there, it's a Bloomsbury book, so that's available now. Right. Thank you, Andrew, for your time. Very much appreciated. And thank you, Lisa. I really appreciate you coming in straight from the spin class. So thank you both.
No problem. Lovely to see you. Have a great day.
Yeah, have a good day, everyone. And enjoy your listening.
Miller's Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA1977 on Twitter.
Miller's Netter, just talking to teachers.